Hello, Radioland, Podcastville, and all the ships at sea. My name is Seth Greenland, and you are listening to the LARB Radio Hour, brought to you by Reader Supported, that's you, the readers, Reader Supported, Los Angeles Review of Books. The science correspondent of The Economist is here. His name is Matt Kaplan, and he's written a new book called The Science of the Magical. Lori's going to get him to use his mind to bend a few spoons. Wally Rudolph is here. He's an actor you might know from Sons of Anarchy. He's written a novel called Mighty Mighty, and he's going to tell us all about it. Joining me are my usual co-conspirators, the founder of LARB. He's an author. He's a chef. He's a bicycle enthusiast. He's a professor at UC Riverside, Tom Lutz. Hello.
Some of those things are true.
And she has been the drama critic at the LA Times. She's written for the New York Times. She is currently working on a tome about Oscar Hammerstein. She's the fiction editor of LARB, Lori Weiner.
Hi, Seth.
Matt Kaplan is the science correspondent for The Economist. He's written for The New York Times, Nature, and National Geographic. His new book is called The Science of the Magical. I'm afraid he's going to tell me Santa Claus doesn't exist, but we booked him anyway. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you for having me.
So, serious question. I'm not going to live forever?
Unfortunately not, no. No matter how we square it, no matter how good the technology gets, you're going to die one of these days.
This interview's over. I can't, Tom, I can't stay in the studio with...
There's something about your book I want to pick a bone with you.
Yeah, go ahead.
It doesn't seem to be very scientific. That is, each of your explanations gives a plausible scientific explanation for something that used to be considered magical, but there's nothing scientific about the relationship necessarily between those two things.
I'd pick a bone with you, actually.
Yeah? When I say it's not a scientific approach, for instance, in the case of the Oracle at Delphi,
yeah,
the kind of scientific explanation you come up with is...
I didn't come up with it, by the way. I got to be really careful here.
Right, that you use to explain it is that it was ethylene gas. Is that right?
Ethylene vapors. But you have to be very careful here because I'm not the one proposing this.
Okay.
This is proposed by a couple of geologists at Wesleyan University and... Ah, God, where's the other guy? He's an archaeologist somewhere. But they're the ones who published the papers on this in peer-reviewed journals.
Okay. So you don't think that that explains anything about prophecy?
I don't think it explains anything about prophecy. I think it explains very much why people believed the site was sacred and why there was magic circulating there. Because you did have a woman who was going into a trance when she was in this lower chamber of the Delphic Oracle. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, let's backstep and explain what we're talking about here. So the Oracle of Delphi was in power for centuries. I mean, her voice... changed civilizations. She had the power to throw out judges, to cause widespread change all throughout society at the time. And I mean, so revered was the Oracle that when the site burned down at one point, contributions came in from all over the classical world to rebuild it. Regardless of country, it didn't matter that it wasn't Greek territory. Everyone wanted to rebuild it because she was that powerful, that amazing. So the concept of the Oracle being able to foresee the future, I think, is a complex question. Mm-hmm. So, first of all, there wasn't just an Oracle. You had a group of priestesses and priests up there who were interviewing people and collecting a lot of information. But why were people migrating there in the first place to give them that information? That certainly comes down to the site itself. And I think that the ethylene vapors may very well have played a role in that. The idea is that ethylene makes you get kind of giddy. It alters thinking procedures, it alters your thought processes. So that could play a role in why people would have believed there was a supernatural activity occurring at the site. It certainly smells sweet. Mm-hmm. As to whether or not that actually helped the Oracle to make better predictions, well, I think we all have to go and try some ethylene vapors to be able to determine whether that would be one way.
That would be scientific.
How's Tuesday? Can we do it Tuesday?
Bring a fire extinguisher. It's highly flammable.
But what about all of the other oracles around the globe through history? Are we assuming there are gases escaping everywhere they happen to be?
No, but remember, not all oracles were doing that. I mean, you were just talking about the importance of entrails. And so, you know, hepatomancy... The processor liver prophecies were a really big deal, going all the way back to 2000 BC. This is interesting because when you start looking at this stuff, you read the literature and think, oh my God, how could you possibly, you know, this is, you look at the Romans doing hepatomancy and they would say, oh, will Uncle Petronius die next month from the plague? You know, will it claim him? And so you chop open a goat, you take out the liver, you go, ooh, look, ooh, the caudate lobe is off kilter, and oh, that portal vein is blocked. This is a very bad sign. Petronius is doomed. You know, you look at that stuff and think, how could they possibly come to those conclusions? This is crazy. But then you have to look at where the tradition started. The tradition started with people going to look at livers before they would build a farm in a location or before they would build a settlement in a new area. And they would ask the gods the question, is this a good place for me to build? Is this a place where my farm will be fertile? And in fact, we know this because Democritus, who's one of the earliest Greek scientists, posits in one of his pieces that there might actually be something real behind the idea of asking a liver if the fields are going to go bad in the years ahead, or if there will be drought. So as I went through the literature, I called the classicists whose names were on the classics papers about hepatomancy, and I said, have any of you guys ever thought about this? Have you ever considered the possibility that there might be some truth to liver prophecy? And they all laughed at me and said, are you crazy? We're not veterinarians. We have no idea. But of course, doing what I do for a living, I know a lot of veterinary pathologists. I write about science for a living. So I called up one of the best veterinary pathologists I knew over at the San Diego Zoo here in California. And I said, Bruce, I need to ask you, if I looked at the liver of a goat, would the liver of the goat be able to tell me if the goat had suffered from a drought in the past 5 years? Or if the goat had suffered periods of disease and pestilence? And he said, oh yeah, definitely. I mean, they're somewhat akin to tree rings. The liver records that information. So if the animal's had a really rough life, you're going to see it. And if it's had a really good life, if rainfall's been excellent and nutrients in the soil are good, you'll see that too. And it all translates through and you can actually glean out information. And I went to go and look at livers, as I describe in the book, at a butcher in London, and I went with my editor from The Economist, Jeff Carr, to actually go dissect livers and try to determine, did this liver come from a happy pig, or did this liver come from a sad pig? And now, the sad part about the whole experiment was, you won't go to a butcher and find any animals that have suffered from plague or drought in recent years. That's impossible. Even so, the animals were staggeringly different. I could instantly detect the difference between an animal that had been raised in a battery farm, you know, shoulder to shoulder, really tight conditions, versus an animal that had been prancing happily through green wooded hills in the Yorkshire moors. I mean, this is, you don't even need to have any training whatsoever to be able to say, well, these are very different from these.
Right, but so, can't you just look at the pigs and see a happy pig and a sad pig?
In fact, actually, no. Ah. A lot of animals will hide the fact that they are suffering or have suffered because it's not in their best interest to look sickly because they'll get picked off first or not get any breeding opportunities.
Just take
a rabbit for a second. So my wife and I have a pet rabbit. You can never tell if the damn things are sick. You never know if they're ill because their evolution has sharpened them to be excellent at hiding it. And I'll say, oh, sweetie, you know, it looks like Monty isn't so happy today. Can you check if he's pooped yet this morning? And, you know, then we'll go and check in his little corner, see if he's pooped enough. And when we count up the poops, if there's not enough poops, we know he's not well. But herbivores, particularly herbivores, it's really hard to tell when they're ill. They cloak it.
One time we were in Africa and we were in Zimbabwe and we talked to a lot of people who live there. And there's a very widespread belief in magic in some African countries. And you know, somebody, this guy was saying that, you know, he had to divorce his first wife because she was a witch and so forth. And they just say it, what? No, but that happened.
That only happens in Africa. I went to high school with that
but
guy.
But it wasn't a metaphor. And you know, do you ever think about the danger in certain cultures of accepting things as wondrous and magic?
I worry about accepting things in our culture as wondrous and magic. Magic is very much alive, even in developed countries. So I spent a lot of time as an emergency medical technician working in and out of hospitals when I was in university. And one of the things that I was really blown away by was how often I dealt with patients whose family did not want them to have medical treatment for religious purposes, or whose family just insisted that there be, you know, 5 minutes of prayer before they were carted away on the ambulance or before they went into the emergency room, because the 5 minutes of prayer were really going to matter. And, you know, it's just absolutely mind-boggling. You've got a patient who needs to see emergency medical treatment, and you're slowing things down because of folklore and belief. And that's, I mean, I don't criticize that, because folklore and belief, as I point out in the very first chapter of this book, play a significant role in the way in which our bodies function. Gene expression, immune function do go hand in hand with our emotions. That much we are starting to understand, and those studies are being replicated, and it's pretty cool. It's all Barbara Fredrickson's stuff at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. So I think it's dangerous to dismiss belief in magic as only existing outside of the developed world anyway. Mm-hmm. In terms of the kind of damage it can do when it is out of control, my God, look at Ebola. One of the major, mm-hmm. you know, a major factor that came in with Ebola spreading as quickly as it did was, after the initial outbreak, community rituals were held so that the whatever dark force that was responsible for the disease could be dealt with. But there were people who had been cleaning up the blood from Ebola patients earlier that day at the community meeting to cleanse that group. And as a result, there was this large gathering of people who all became contaminated, and it caused widespread death. So folklore matters. Folklore matters in a big way.
The book is Science of the Magical. Matt Kaplan, thanks for coming in.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
This is Seth Greenland. I'm here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner. You are listening to the LARB Radio Hour, 90.7 KPFK, Los Angeles. Eli Horowitz has been an editor at McSweeney's. He's an author. And Eli, would it be all right if I called you a literary ringmaster?
I guess it's your show, so I'm not going to make any rules.
Okay.
That's very wise.
You've got a new project called The Pickle Index. It's a book. It's an app. We hope you'll tell us all about it. Welcome to the LARB Radio Hour.
Thanks for having me.
So the first thing I want to ask you is to identify McSweeney's, because there's so many literary projects on the web now and so many literary magazines. And what is it about McSweeney's that's unique? What's their mission? Because I think there's a direct connection from that to the Pickle Index project.
Yeah, well, I do see a connection between all the projects. McSweeney's, I guess it's been around for over 15 years now. I was there sort of for the middle 10. What makes it unique? I don't know. It's very hard to tell from the inside. I think when it began, there was a time when literary magazines were sort of a group of noble outsiders kind of upholding a tradition, but had maybe felt a little beaten down by a certain cultural indifference. And McSweeney's was sort of ignorant of that, or oblivious of that, or untroubled by that, and so brought a new kind of energy to the proceedings that I think readers and writers really responded to. And that's something we also did a lot, which leads into the Pickle Index, is, you know, McSweeney's was started sort of at the rise of the first dot-com boom, and, you know, caring about books as physical objects was a little paradoxical, but in a way it was a response to that, because if it was going to be on paper, it really needed to earn its paper and think about why it was a physical form.
It made a lot of beautiful books, McSweeney's, and
yeah,
continues
hopefully.
To.
Hopefully they were beautiful, but also very responsive to their content in a sense. You know, the layout, the design, the physical form really understood the story we were trying to tell.
And speaking of being responsive to the form, the Pickle Index on as an app, as an iPhone app, I think is the way to go. I mean, you're given so many options and new chapters come in every day for 10 days. And so the app gives you the sense that there's all of these fun things happening just outside of your periphery, which a book really can't do because it's contained in your hand, right? I mean, the play part of it seems to come out best on the app.
Exactly. I think that's very true. I mean, so what we really tried to do was think about the different forms and shape the story and the experience so it could really take advantage to what the form can do. So as you say, the physical one allows for certain physical interaction, manipulation, a certain tactile reality to the thing. But the digital, yeah, allows for that sense of play, that sense of immersion and exploration and freeform experience. That's really much more of a digital experience.
And then just for the listener who has not yet downloaded the Pickle Index app, it's kind of purports to be a cookbook of pickles and other pickled vegetables or brined vegetables. But if you follow one of the recipe writers, I believe Flora Bialy, then you get the whole story. But if you look at some of the other recipes, then you just get a recipe. And the reader is allowed to enter their own recipes. I entered one yesterday for pickles. So I was hoping maybe you could make sure that gets on the website.
No, the citizens will soon be sampling your delicacies all across the nation, I'm sure. In the world of the story, there's this mandatory pickle recipe exchange network. Every citizen has to write or forward a fermentation recipe every day, sort of the cynical way of rebranding the peasant's cuisine. And so that's true of both of the editions, but the print version is sort of an outside-in, a traditional reading experience of that, whereas the app is inside out. Like you say, you're actually within that recipe exchange network, experiencing it over the 10 days along with the other people in this adventure.
And you're playing with a lot of motifs that we're familiar with from the internet. Like, for instance, if I pick a recipe, I get a picture of all the people in my area who this recipe has gone through before it's gotten to me.
Mm-hmm. I think in books, we're a little more familiar with the technique of sort of pretending it's one thing, but it's really another. You know, it's written as a series of letters to the Alumni Magazine, or it's written as annotations to a poem, or written as a cookbook. You know, all these things can be ways of telling a novel. That's something we're kind of used to, but in digital forms, we're just starting at. So the idea of a novel pretending to be a social network, for example, was kind of new and fun to play with.
And yeah, very fun. Have you ever seen the play The Sunshine Boys?
I haven't. That's an early Neil Simon, right?
Exactly. Well, there's a discussion that two characters have in that play about how pickle is such a funny word.
Right. I mean, pickles were not at all present in the early versions of this book. It's sort of, I had a basic outline, a series of events. I wrote it out. It was very flat and too direct. And then sort of the subsequent year, we're just trying to make it fun and interesting. And the easiest and quickest and most efficient way to make something fun or interesting, I found, was just to add a lot of pickles to it.
Well, you've got the P sound and the K sound, so it's comedy gold when you put them together.
The sound is good. It's very versatile. Almost everything can be pickled. Got a lot of cultural resonance for good and for bad.
And they're delicious.
All right. The book is The Pickle Index. Eli Horowitz, thanks for coming on the LARB Radio Hour.
Thanks for having me.
This is Seth Greenland. I'm here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner. You are listening to the LARB Radio Hour, 90.7 KPFK, Los Angeles. Wally Rudolph is here. You might know him as an actor. He's been on Sons of Anarchy. His new book is called Mighty Mighty. Welcome to the LARB Radio Hour.
Thank you, Seth.
So, Wally, when I was looking at your book, one of the first things I noticed was, I'm going to play a little word association game with you. Todd Goldberg, Mark Haskell Smith, Rob Roberge. I'm seeing a relationship here. There's a trend of some kind.
I think coming off of my first book, Four Corners, Todd became a friend. Rob knows Rob. And Mark is a stalwart of the LA literary community. And he was nice enough to do me a solid, to be completely honest. But
your point is that these three men teach at UC.
There's a UC Riverside.
There's a UC Riverside. Yes, that's correct.
Right. Yeah. Which is where I teach, of course. Yeah. So they're my colleagues.
And so I'm glad that they kind of pre-approved you before before I met the book. So I was ready to read it. Now the book is among other things, and I think this is true of your earlier book as well, right? There's a kind of Catholic culture that's part of these books.
You are the very first Tom to call it out. Yes, it's a big part of the book. Kind of the duality of life and faith, and the way faith interacts, and kind of in the most pragmatic of terms, in day-to-day life for regular people. You know, the characters in my book, they aren't coming from the sort of kind of literary contemporary pedigree that you're used to seeing. These are, I literally go to great lengths to kind of create the lives of the people we pass on the street, people we kind of miss in the day-to-day.
Well, in Mighty Mighty, the new novel, Norman, who's the first character we meet, has retired as a cop in Chicago. And he is very interested. For a while, he's figuring out what he's going to do with his life now that he's retired. He tries on a few schemes, gives them all up, decides basically to go to church as his retirement project. And his priest tells him, pray until your knees hurt and then pray some more.
Yes.
And that's basically what he's doing when we meet him.
Yeah, that he is at this point in his life that he is searching. He is a widower. He is he's having problems with his 45-year-old son who is struggling with drug abuse, and he is seeking guidance. And I think the role of faith can take on a lot of forms as people get older. I think it becomes people get scared to talk about the fact that a religious community or a religion provides a way of life for a lot of people, mm-hmm. a whole lot of people. It's a way for them to interact with a community. And for Norman, with him being a retiree, I think because of his history, not to give too much away, but with his history with the Chicago police, he's looking for absolution and absolution through God. And much like in my first novel, Frank was also looking for absolution I had my own run-ins with drug abuse for a long time. And I think by the end of it, I realized that I was spending all this energy trying to define what my religion was and how I saw God. And I spent so much time, and I realized whether I like it or not at this point, for practical purposes, when I close my eyes at night and I'm talking to whatever you want to call it, I do see some clouds. I do see some light. I see that when I'm in a Catholic church and I go to service, or with my wife when we go to Episcopalian service, I feel grace. Mm-hmm. And I realized I was spending so much energy trying to define that. But in the practicality of day to day, that's the way. And so I try to honor it, but not overthink it and not let it take me in another direction where I'm trying to define what the characters, why they have such a draw, whether it be to Catholicism or any other religion.
Mm. I was raised Catholic, so that's one of the reasons I recognize the impulse in the book and the structure of the book as having a kind of Catholic structure. I think that it's common for us to think about grace in literature, that is, moments of grace. That's a Catholic concept that's still part of the general culture. I'm not sure absolution is in the same way. Part of the general culture.
No, it isn't. And I think that idea of that black and white vision of absolution is what gets a lot of people in trouble. We start getting these black and whites of good and bad. That's where Catholicism and a lot of organized religion loses me. But as it relates to faith and grace in our day-to-day lives, I mean, let's be honest, the way things are in contemporary society, whether you like it or not, you have to have some level of faith. With people running around with automatic weapons, there's some level of faith that you step out the door, literally these days, and that you're not going to catch one, you know?
This is kind of a personal question, I suppose, but you talked about your drug addiction in the past, and did you do a 12-step program coming out of that?
No, I can't. I did try my hand at 12-step several times. I eventually reached my sobriety through a long bit of cognitive behavioral therapy, which eventually that's what took me to sobriety. But I'm familiar with the 12 steps, and I think it's a great, I mean, back to the religion thing, it's literally, it's a way for a lot of people to navigate their lives that I think is completely valid. And for a lot of people, that's what they need. Mm.
And what is that? What is that 12th step? What is the 12th step? Oh, making amends.
Yes.
And it strikes me that the idea of making amends, that's the 12th step, is related to the idea of absolution, but it's an absolution that's not granted to you. It's an absolution that you earn through interaction.
And yes, and I think it's also, you know, a big part is, you know, that for, you know, the first step of realizing you're powerless. And I think that level of humility, if there's another common theme in my work, is you'll see that a lot of my characters, they lack that emotional awareness, you know, is on a personal level to get to that place where they allow themselves that humility. And, you know, it can be kind of like watching a train wreck sometimes in some of my books. But at the same time, I think there's those stories need to get told.
Of course.
What was it that led you to start writing novels?
Short answer, I was lucky enough to study under a couple of great writers at the College of Santa Fe, the now defunct College of Santa Fe. I studied under Jack Butler, who was Pulitzer nominee for Living in Little Rock, from Miss Little Rock, Jiu Jitsu for Christ, some of his great work, and also Greg Glazner on the poetry side, who got nominated for who won Walt Whitman for, I believe it was Iron Chair. So I had these. I was lucky enough, and the people who went to my school at the time study under them. And I was studying acting at the same time. And then when I got out of school, acting kind of took over. I was constantly writing for the stage, diddling at fiction. I think it was about 8 years ago that I felt, in my early 30s, I felt like I had finally reached a point that I had something to say, that I had a stance, that I could bring my life experience to the page. Not necessarily, my stuff isn't autobiographical, it's fiction, pretty straightforward fiction. But I think it takes some distance to bring all that life experience to the page.
I was really surprised when I clicked through from the Wally Rudolph website to your IMDb page to find that you're a different person on IMDb.
Well, my full name is Walter Rudolph Wong the Third. Mm-hmm. But I separated them early on. Now, you know, 10 years later, I'm pretty happy with it.
So you're Wally Wong as an actor.
Well, yeah, I'm
and
Walter
Wally
Wong.
Rudolph as a.
Yeah, I think I came to writing with, there was a level of wanting a little bit more creative freedom to get back to creating work strictly on my own terms for my own artistic needs. And acting is definitely, I take it deadly seriously, but it's also my job. And I look at it differently. I don't look for the same level of creative satisfaction for it.
All right, the book is Mighty Mighty. Wally Rudolph, thanks for coming to the LARP Radio Hour.
Thank you so much. This was great, guys. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks to Matt Kaplan, Wally Rudolph. Our apologies to BJ Novak. Once again, we ran out of time, but he said he will come back next week. I don't know. I think he may be out of patience at this point. Thanks to our producer and moral conscience, Jerry Gorin, our crack production assistant, Ernesto Aureliano, the czar of scheduling, Aviva de Kornfeld, and of course the irreplaceable Sid Biggs, without whom I personally could not do this show. And I don't want to forget the generosity of the Goldhirsch Foundation. We couldn't do it without their generosity either. Find us on the web at www.lareviewofbooks.org. Download us on iTunes. Better yet, give us a rating. 5 stars is good. For Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner, this is Seth Greenland. Thanks for listening.